Are you on dope?
Yes.
What kind?
Musical dope.
You get high?
Yes.
Off of what?
Music.
Are you on a trip or something?
Yes.
What kind of a trip?
Music.
How old are you?
I'm old in mind, but young in age.
This is Brianna Marie, and you're listening to Soul Discovery, a place run by passion and really dedicated to its music, artists, producers, and record labels, which makes it a unique place, but also a place where listeners come to really absorb themselves and can tap into their emotions and take themselves on a discovery of their own.
Jazz vibes, jazz vibes, jazz vibes, jazz vibes, jazz vibes, jazz vibes.
You are listening to Soul Discovery. In the studio, as my guest, Mr. Snowboy himself. Good afternoon, sir.
Afternoon. Great to be here.
Yeah, at last.
Yes, indeed, yes.
Good journey up?
Easy, easy. 60 miles, but went quick.
Yeah, yeah.
And even with two screaming kids in the back of the car.
They're lovely, though.
Thanks.
And she's gone across the road with the old...
With the missus, with the credit card, yeah. Oh, dear. Oh, dear, oh, dear.
I know. So, today, we're going to be talking about your new book, if you're going to let people know what it's called.
Yeah, From Jazz, Funk and Fusion to Acid Jazz, published by Straight No Chaser. Chaser Publications, Paul Bradshaw, the jazz expert. It's his first book.
Right, and we're going to be looking at some of the music as well through the course of the show, talking about the book. I've actually gone back into my box and had a look and
have
bought
you?
Something, just in case. You never had enough with you, but you've got enough with you, I'm afraid.
Yeah, no.
that first tune in, then?
I just thought we'd start off with a couple of the original dancers, pre the jazz dance scene, the stuff that inspired the jazz to get played on the dance floor. That was Mandrill, Feeling Good. And this next track is Angela Beaufield, Music Makes the World Go Round.
Snowboy in the studio on Soul Discovery.
Trash man didn't get my trash today. Oh, why? Because they want more pay. Buses on strike gonna raise the fare, so they can help pollute the air. But there's
and they're blaming it on longer hair. Big men smoking in their easy chair. They got a fat cigar and they don't care. Uh-uh. But that's what makes the world go round. The ups and downs are carousel. Changing people's heads around. Go underground, young man. People make the world go round. Yeah.
Field. Nice choice.
Incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
Amazing, amazing.
God, it's been a long time since I heard that, but wow.
Original Broken Beats.
Yeah, fantastic. Right, the book. What's the idea? Why did you decide to put it pen to paper?
Many reasons, really. Initially came across the idea when I first started my hi-hat jazz sessions at the Blue Note in London in the mid-90s. I remember just overhearing a couple of jazz dancers talking about something that happened in the past, and they're arguing, actually, not talking, and I, even though I was kind of, from a distance, I wasn't involved in the conversation, I thought, no, they're both wrong. I remembered it as being,
right.
And I thought, all this, it's quite recent history, but all this information was already getting forgotten about. Yeah. And, what spurred me on even more so is, as much as it's an incredible book as it is, myself, along with a lot of people, were obviously very disappointed with last night DJ Saved My Life and the fact that our entire scene, countrywide scene, was completely dismissed in that book. And in fact, the first issue of the first print of Last Night DJ Saved My Life, we only had four lines, and our jazz funk scene got dismissed as a load of white sock wearing Essex boys.
Yeah, throwing beer.
Yeah, admittedly, I was a white sock wearing Essex boy, but I mean, it's obviously a countrywide scene, and as big as the house music scene ever became, and a massive culture, completely kind of forgotten about. I mean, I say I love the book, but that spurred me on, actually, the fact that we weren't really involved in that book, and I thought, no, you know.
Right, yeah, and so pen to paper, what was the course of it? How many years did it take, weeks?
I've been telling people for ages it was over a period of 10 years, but Ed Stokes reminded me the other week that I interviewed him in 1997, so it's 12 years.
Wow.
Over a period of, it didn't take me 12 years to write, it took me over a period of 12 years, because I did actually give up on it a few times, so once I actually didn't even put pen to paper for a year, I just got so disillusioned with it and just didn't think anyone was going to be interested. You know, I mean, I interviewed 200 people, over 200 people for the book, so, and it's very time consuming. You always had this thing at the back of your mind is, you know, are people going to be interested after all this effort, you know, so.
And you're totally wrong, because everybody's interested.
No, I know, I'm absolutely shocked.
It's fantastic. And your next tune?
This is, of course, one of the great original jazz dance classics, Central Park by Chick Corea.
Yes.
We'll be right back.
special guest in the studio is Snowboy, who's brought some fantastic tunes in, and we were talking about his fantastic new book. It's officially released now, is it?
Yeah. It's a funny thing. It's actually on and off. It's been out for 2 months, but we kept on having problems with it.
Right.
In its latest incarnation, it's only been out about a week now, but it came out a couple of months ago with a load of typographic errors in it, which was the problem is it was designed on a program in this country called Quark, but it was printed in America, and in America it's not industry standard Quark, and
right.
It did silly things between one program and another. And I was at the publisher's house one day when the book arrived for me to check through to proofread. When I saw it, I said to the publisher, look at all these spelling mistakes. I never put all these in there. And he went, oh my God, you know. And he said, it won't come out like that. And the same day, I was getting emails from people saying, oh, I've just bought your new book. And I thought, so basically what happened, the printers in America had put it out for sale when I hadn't even proofread the book and, okayed the book, I should say, signed it off, if you like. So the book was only out for about 4 days and it was absolutely flying out, but we stopped it, you know, straight away. You know, can't go out like that. It was a complete error that it went out so early. And then again, a couple of weeks ago, we got the book back, and again it was out again for the public, and there was still not many, but there was still some typographic errors in there. So the latest one doesn't have any in it might be the odd spelling mistake, but that's the human error rather than anything else. But yeah, so it's been a bit of a pain in the backside really, because it's been frustrating for the public because they. They know people that have got copies, so they go and order one, and then it's not available because we've withdrawn it. They've had to wait a month or so.
Give details about the book where you can obtain it later.
Oh, yeah.
But from jazz funk to fusion to acid jazz. Mm. Now, back in 75, 76, with the Northern scene really strong, the Clubs Down, Gold Mine, etc., with Chris Hill.
Mm.
How did the jazz get tangled up with the soul scene? That's one thing I've never understood. We just kind of accepted at the time, didn't we?
Yeah. It was quite an unusual thing. I think it's because we're a small country and think things can spread a lot quicker than, say, in the US, obviously such a massive country. Scenes move, scenes spread very quickly. And I think, along with the soul and the latest disco imports, obviously we were playing a lot of what they called the soul jazz or the crossover jazz stuff that was massive in America at that time as well. Like obviously Grover Washington, you know, Hubert Laws, stuff that's on CTI, Kudu, and the Mazelle Brother production stuff,
Definitely,
obviously Donald Byrd, Bobby Humphries.
It was kind of accepted, wasn't it?
It
went along with the flow.
Yeah, it was accepted, but I mean, I don't think in all nightclubs, but certainly a majority of the clubs,
Especially down, we're not going to talk about this north-south divide, because I don't think it exists in my mind anyway.
No.
But it did happen at that point where certain jazz tracks weren't played up north.
Yeah.
Because of places like Wigan and places like that, because it weren't accepted. But it was happening. But we'll go into that later with certain DJs and everything.
Yeah.
But this next record.
Yeah. I think this record, what can you say about this record? Lonnie Liston Smith was quite surprised when he came to the UK when this record was reissued in the late 70s, and saw everyone at the Flicks All Nighter in Dartford dancing to this. He said, I've never seen people dance to this record before. Lonnie Liston Smith never made this as a dance record, but it was accepted as a new release over here, 1975, expansions of course. It got some play in America. It was a massive hit in America, massive hit. Number one jazz album, got to about 78 in the soul charts, and a little bit of club play in America, but this was played all over the country here. We'll be right back.
Soul Discovery in the Jazz Zone. Lonnie Liston Smith. What can you say about that?
Well, it doesn't get any better than that, does it?
Oh, no.
It just doesn't get any better than that. It was a funny thing, you know, doing the book. Obviously, you know, I went through every edition of the American magazine Billboard from 1970 to 1980 to kind of, you know, trace what was happening from a club point of view in America. And of course, recently that book's just come out, Disco Files, hasn't it, with Vince Aletti's column, famous column from '70s. I mean, obviously my book really is concerning the British scene. So, you know, I can only judge how this stuff did in America just by their charts and by the DJ columns. Obviously the very famous people doing the columns like obviously Vince Aletti, and I think I can't remember who did Billboard now. I think Larry Levan did it at some point, but that all legends, and all the charts were by all these legendary DJs that we all know about now over here, the American club DJs. Even though I saw how well these records did in the charts in the States, I mean, I know that they got an immense amount of radio play, but how well they did, I can only judge about how well they did on the dance floors in the States, just judging by from the DJ columns in the DJ charts. I mean, you may well, I know you get a lot of American listeners. I'd be quite interested to know, if there's any of the older listeners out there from those days, you know, say from the mid 70s, I'd be quite interested to know, like, you know, if there was clubs in their areas or in their community that was playing this kind of stuff, because it certainly didn't reflect on any of the DJ charts whatsoever or the columns in these American magazines.
No, that's what made the UK special, because we had our own scene, but we had the sound, we had the ear for that sound, didn't we? What they would have played wouldn't have never got played here in the UK up to a point.
No, well, it was quite weird. I mean, I did actually see, just for one week, I did actually see expansions in a DJ's chart, a DJ I had not heard of in Manhattan. In the same chart, there's like Barry Manilow, you know, it could be Magic or whatever it was called, in the same chart. I mean, that doesn't make any sense whatsoever, you know. That was quite
That's how diverse they were, you see, because, yeah, well, expansions. Now, going back, people like Chris Hill, and I apologise again that Chris Hill couldn't make it today, but he will definitely be coming up on the show, and good afternoon to you, Chris. I know you're tuned in as well. The Gold Mine.
Yes.
What can you say about that place?
Well, I mean, what can you say about the Gold Mine? I mean, you know,
for our listeners that don't actually, tell them where it was actually situated.
Yes, well, as I always say, the Gold Mine is on a place called Canvey Island, which is, if you follow the River Thames out towards France, it's the last place you hit on the left-hand side on the way out of the Thames.
The last place you can get a drink.
It's about 40 miles outside of London. Probably in those days, it would have probably been 100% white community, I would have said. Very, very working class. Very insular, because obviously, you know, it's a very, very tight community. And it was quite a shock, you know, for there to be a club like the Gold Mine there, which obviously hardly any locals went to the Gold Mine. It was all, obviously people would travel from all over the country to go there. I mean, it was...
Sleep in the car park.
They did sleep in the car park, yeah. I knew the second I walked in there, the atmosphere hit me like a ton of bricks. I'd never seen or heard anything like it in my life.
No. You know,
it was one of those moments where the there was that kind of crackle of excitement and tension there, you know, and
yeah.
And
you knew you'd arrived to what you wanted to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Chris, he was just so special. He'd drop in certain tracks alongside the Philadelphia, the Motown, and then he'd drop a jazz track in between.
Yeah.
And it used to blow me. I used to think, how does this kind of work in it? But it did.
Yeah, that's right. Well, of course, you know, thanks to tracks like, Expansions of Lonely Listen Smith, I mean, which some may call it jazz funk, some may call it jazz fusion, but that was the good thing with tracks like that. It did open doors for other stuff to be played, and as you remember, Mick, is it wasn't just like in the north they thought it was their way of introducing jazz was in what they called jazz breaks, you know, maybe three tracks every now and then during the course of the evening. But of course that's exactly how we did it down south as well. It wasn't particularly a north thing or a southern thing, but like, you know, if you waited long enough, you were going to get a cluster of three or four jazz tracks played, weren't you, by people that were brave enough to play them initially, like, you know, obviously like Chris and Bob Jones. And
yeah, but the thing, not like the northern scene, which I'm not dishing because that's part of my roots.
Yeah.
When the jazz stuff come on, the soul boys actually stayed on the dance floor as well.
Yes.
It never emptied.
Yeah.
And that's what was so unique.
Well, that's right. You see, I came out of the rockabilly scene, I just got sick to death of all the violence in those days between the rockabillies and the Teddy Boys, the younger generation versus the newer generation. I came straight out of that. And when I went to art college, in 1978, everyone was going to the gold mine. I wasn't going anywhere because, as I say, I wasn't going to the rockabilly clubs, and I got dragged there, really, to the gold mine. I was absolutely bored silly. And to actually go in there, where the music's totally alien to me whatsoever. Yeah. Nothing like I was used to the 12 bar blues of Crazy Cavern and the Rhythm Rockers, as I put in the book. You know, so I couldn't differentiate between a soul record and a jazz record and a disco record because I didn't know any of that kind of music. I never heard any of that kind of music before. It was completely different. Well, so that was a good thing because just the fact that I did accept all the music on face value, I didn't know what was what. I think what the appeal was is the fact that everyone in there was into it. Everyone cared about the dancing, the way they looked.
Well, the look was special then.
It was all kind of the casual thing, wasn't it? I mean, people really cared about how they dressed, and the weirdest thing for me was at the gold mine is that the look at the gold mine, the soul boy look at the time was the 50s American college boy look. They had flat tops and American college jackets on. The guys did anyway. And of course, that's exactly what I was wearing from the rocking scene. I was worried I was going to get beaten up going in there, and I walked in and loads of people dressed like that. So I immediately felt at home and I was hearing all this music that was in, never heard anything like it. I can't say that I can't judge one way or the other about, you know, what was what and what was played and, you know, stuff. It was just a whole new world to me, but I took to it immediately. Straight away I was buying those records.
Harlem River Drive.
can you say?
Oh my goodness. What's interesting, I think, about that the producers, the Mazelle brothers, yeah. is that really, all these albums that they produced, like Donald Byrd and Bobby Humphries and Johnny Hammond and everything, really, it could be any artist, couldn't it? Because, like, Mazelle brothers kind of wrote most of the tracks on all of the albums, and they could almost be, the albums could be by the Mazelle brothers featuring whoever, you know.
Exactly, yeah.
It's such a, you know. It's funny, you talk about the gold mine. There's one thing I wish that I could have experienced at the time. It's all very well, you know, we talk about the gold mine and stuff, but I really, really wish that I was just a little bit too young to have experienced seeing Colin Curtis at the at Rafters and Castanelli's and all his classic clubs, because, you know, that guy, you know, he's such a legend, and I'm very, very proud to call him a friend, and one of the world's great innovators of black music on the dance floor, just like Chris and Bob Jones. As I talk about the excitement of walking into the gold mine, I mean, I'm sure there's 10,000 people that could say exactly the same thing about Collins clubs. I just wish I could have experienced them at the time as well. So
yeah, and the thing about Colin as well, he hasn't stopped moving. He keeps progressing all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
He's not blinking in any way, is he?
No, he's not. He's not. No,
it's fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
But talking about Colin, and we say there's no north-south divide, which I agree with you, which is in your book. There isn't.
No.
But one record that absolutely blew the scene apart at the time was Gil Scott-Heron when he came in with that track.
Yeah.
And it was just so unique and special. I don't know who broke it at the time. Was it the North or was it the South?
No, it was...
just one of them things that happened.
Yeah, because I hate the idea of North-South. I hate that. Mm. I mean, I appreciate that economically there's one, probably still is, but obviously people didn't travel like as much in those days. And you had people like Frank Elson writing columns in Blues and Soul magazine at the time, obviously a northern guy who was really, really anti-South, and he did a lot to stoke all this rubbish up. Yeah. I'm just so glad that there was people like Chris and Colin that were in contact and respected each other. The Bottle, you know, I mean, when you consider that was played like in the northern scene, must have sounded completely alien, and must have taken a lot of bottle to play the Bottle, if you like. It was played down south. It's not a matter of who broke it. It was played as a new release, but interestingly enough, it was massive in the discotheques in the States at the time.
Yeah,
you know, so
very much so.
Yeah, yeah. So
Snowboy in the studio on Soul Discovery. Wow.
You see that black boy over there running scared, his old man in a bottle. He done quit his 9-to-5, he drank full time, and now he's living in a bottle. See that black boy over there running scared, his old man got a problem, and it's a bad one. He ain't done fond of damn near everything, his old woman waiting to pay for bottom. And don't you think it's a crime when time after time after time people in a bottle, there's people living in the bottle. Listen to me, see that sister, her show was fine. Oh, she's finally drinking wine from the bottle. She told me, oh man, committed a crime, he's doing time, now she's hanging in the bottle. I seen her out there on the avenue all by herself, sure need help from the bottle. I seen her, your man tried to help her, oh, she cussed him out and hit him in the head with the bottle. They turned to me, they asked me, Gil, don't you think it's a crime? No way. And time after time after time, people in the bottle, there's people showing up in the bottle. Here's another good example. You see that jet in a wrinkled suit, there ain't nothing damn near blown his cool to the bottom. He was a doctor helping young girls along, if they wasn't too far gonna have problems.
deep. Offenders of the dollar eagle said, what you doing, man? Illegal. Now he's in the bottle. And now we watch him every day. He's trying to chase the pigeons away from the bottom. He turned to me, he said, man, don't you think it's a crime? The way time after time friends of mine in the bottom. There's people showing up in the bottom. Come on, hit the lick one time, Steve. Come looking for me, you know where I'm bound to be, in the bottom. Turn around, look around on any corner. If you see some brother looking like a goner, it's gonna be me. Sing the song. Na 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 na.
Yeah, fantastic.
Incredible.
Sounds fantastic, doesn't it?
Yeah, amazing. Incredible, incredible.
Yeah, so over the course of doing your research, DJs across the UK, did you actually target certain people that brought the jazz through influence through from the 70s? Up to the present day?
Yeah, what I did is I did a bit of a wish list. It was a massive, massive list over a few pages of A4, you know, double columns, treble columns of people, and just ticked them off as I went along. Because obviously I'm lucky for what I do for a living, you know, as a musician and as a DJ. Obviously I travel a lot, so what I was tending to do, like say if I was going to the north of England, I would occasionally go up, like say 2 days early, before the gig I had to do, and then spend those few days interviewing people or stay on an extra day or two, you know, so I utilised that time and the expense of the petrol, you know, in the car. So you know, for someone that would do a book like this that didn't do kind of what I do for a living, it would have perhaps taken a lot longer. Say, just because I travel a lot anyway, so I was using that time wisely to interview these people. But I started off originally, by the way, I went through every edition of Blues and Soul from 70 to probably 90, all the black music and jazz reviews, all the black echoes, and I made a list of who did what at what time. So I already had all this information. Quite often I was having to correct the people I was interviewing, so
right.
They were remembering it 2 years later. With respect, I think the worst one. And I'm sure he's listening. My dear friend Dr. Bob Jones, he admits that he may have things a year or two out here and there, and he was certainly right there, you know. But but it was interesting that there was. I think the problem with researching the book is that the more I got into it, the harder it got. Actually, it didn't get any easier because I suddenly started to concentrate on areas like Leeds or Sheffield. Birmingham, complete nightmare. There was so many more people involved than I realised there. Mm. But I like to feel that I gave really good respect to these people because I did spend a lot of time in all those areas going into it and taking my time. You know, I didn't interview everyone, but I felt that the most important thing is the story, you know. So if I felt that I'd got all the information I could possibly need and more, then that's good enough, you know. With Birmingham, I went there quite a few times. Once I just, you know, out of my own pocket, I just stayed in a B&B on the outskirts of Birmingham for about eight or nine days and was hitting loads of interviews every day, you know, and just kept on and on and on until I got you know, everything I needed, really.
And was there anything that you came across, discoveries that you didn't know about on the vinyl side, jazz track?
No, I don't think so, really. I thought it was quite interesting, was that there were DJs saying that they were telling me about tracks that they didn't think that I would perhaps know, you know, know of. They said, oh, this was bigger, but you probably don't know that one. And you don't like to correct people and say, oh, well, yeah, that was played here and there as well, blah, blah, blah. Mm. But, you know, before the DJ started going back in time, you know, like going back into the back catalogues of the record labels and, you know, looking for their own discoveries.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, you know, the jazz we were playing, it was all new release stuff anyway, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. And that's, later on we'll talk about people like Paul Murphy and people like that started digging back. But, going back to Bob Jones, now, Bob influenced me big time back in the 70s and very early 80s, some of the stuff that he used to drop. In a roundabout way, Bob has kind of been overlooked, hasn't he? He influenced so many people at the time and still does today.
Yeah.
Because, you brought one of his tracks in.
This is a track called Sunday Night, Let's Get It On. It was one of those, you know, Bob really went through a phase of playing a lot of kind of R&B organ stuff, didn't he? And you're right what you say about Bob. I mean, you know, Bob, he always says that, you know, he's not one to shout about himself, whereas there's plenty of DJs
who would drop a Jimmy Smith track like the Chicken Shack? On radio.
Yeah, I know.
Unbelievable.
I know. I mean, that, you know, really, Bob's the kind of the people's champion, as it were, wasn't he? Mm. You know, he was. Yeah. He's the small room DJ that breaks the moody stuff. You know.
Yeah. Places like Caister and that, when they decided to have a jazz room in the end.
Yeah.
It was people like Bob Jones. I used to leave the main room if I knew Bob was going to be on, because you knew you were going to hear something completely different from the main room. Which I suppose we can go into that later. But that was that the start when they decided to have a jazz room away from the main room? Was that the split?
I don't know about so much a split. I think that it was an indication that, you know, there was, you know, there was more of an interest, in other stuff that you wouldn't necessarily be able to play, you know, to a big room.
Right.
So, I think it's something that I do mention in the book, that really, the DJs were, on the whole, not all, but majority of the DJs were, they were only one step ahead, or, you know, in knowledge, that in some cases they weren't any more knowledgeable than the punters that they were DJing to. So, like, and I think what was happening was, I think all this music that was getting played on the dance floor, you know, I think the punters were learning quickly, you know, and getting educated very quickly, and I think that they were demanding more and more, you know, deeper
to feed their hunger.
To feed their hunger, yeah.
Which is happening today, as still continues.
Still continues.
You can't get enough of it, can you?
Oh, actually, just before we play this track, I don't want to get in trouble with anyone. The trouble is with things going out live. I do want to point out, of course, there are DJs that discovered records. You know, that went on to discover their own records, that no one else was playing. It's just, I was just trying to make the point that there was a time when all the jazz that was being played was new release. But I think it was after that period where, you know, people started to discover their own stuff. I don't want to get lynched. I thought I'd better just clear that one up. Okay, back to Bob Jones.
This is synonymous with Bob anyway, this track.
He broke this without a doubt. Incredible. Sunny night, let's get it on.
Right now we'd like to do a little thing. Let's get it on. Go, oh, don't you know, you can move. let yourself go. Go on and burn. If you don't know, learn. Go on and cook. And let me take another look. But let's get it on. Let's get it on. Let's get it on. Let's get it on. Let's get it on.
How fantastic is that?
Oh, dear,
oh, dear. We nearly got carried away there, didn't we?
We did, didn't we? Yeah. I did actually want to say, DJs don't realise out there, I mean, this is a good thing for any young guys out there, guys and girls, I should say, DJing is that you don't realise how much you influence other people's lives and, you know, and music tastes and stuff. I mean, I'm very proud. The one thing is nice for me with the book is it gives me a chance in some ways to thank, pay tribute, you know, to people that kind of in some way shape my lives. I go all over the world as a musician, and recording artist and as a DJ. And yet, really, if it hadn't been for people like, Bob Jones, Chris Hill, Chris Brown, Sean French, people like that, instilled that into me, you know, yeah. and later, of course, Colin, as I got to know him, and the hundreds of other DJs over the years that you go and check out. But, you know, these music shapes your music taste and in some ways can send you off into, other areas. I'd never have thought about being a musician, you know, before,
And we've said this on the show before that, when I was guessing, at the start it's just a hobby, isn't it? And then it kind of takes over your life.
It's, yeah.
You're hungry for it, and you're saying about DJs influence you. Frenchie was one of the greatest, DJs in my opinion in the scene.
Yeah.
And at that time you had Robbie Vincent coming in, on the radio.
On the radio, yeah.
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 Now, Radio London on a Saturday, you could not miss it, could you?
No, it's incredible, isn't it? They like everyone I knew, and myself included in this as well. Yeah, everyone used to record Robbie Vincent's show, didn't they? That,
yes.
That if you were in range of that station, everyone used to record that on cassette and play it throughout the week.
He had a big influence on the jazz scene, didn't he?
Well, he did because of, I mean, particularly. He used to make a feature of it on his show eventually, didn't he? With his, was it his Fusion Few or Fusion 40 or whatever it is?
Yeah.
I've forgotten what it was called now. And, unfortunately, we couldn't listen to him in those days, but I suppose his equivalent in the North would have been Mike Shaft, of course, in Piccadilly Radio in Manchester. But, certainly from a Southern perspective, the influence of Robbie in his show, I mean, it was the, because, and of course, you know, he'd always be mentioning, you know, mentioning people from, what we called the tribes, didn't we? All the crowds of, the cliques that used to go to these different clubs and support certain DJs. You know, people used to listen to his show to find out what was going on elsewhere that night as well. It was a real community kind of program, wasn't it?
Very much so, yeah. And,
the hub of the community.
Yeah, it was like a newsletter where to go that night,
yeah,
and who would be DJing where.
And his taste was impeccable, Robbie's taste. Absolutely, yeah. And great, still a fantastic radio presenter.
Yeah, and his imports, the exclusives he got at the time, it was phenomenal what he was turning round.
Well, yeah, because that was one thing that I was really surprised about in my research in the book. Of course, the main importer then, of course, was Tony Monson, with Disc Empire. Tony told me this, Robbie told me this, and Chris Hill told me, so it's got to be true, is that you couldn't really get any more up front from a Southern perspective than Robbie or Chris Hill, because Tony Monson, in those days, he used to have to go and collect the records from the airport. Tony went home, he'd make a stop off at Robbie's house and stop off at Chris's house. I mean, that's straight from the airport.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't get any more up front than that. So,
no, you can't.
Because Tony knew that Chris is going to, if Chris plays it, everyone's going to want it.
Mm.
And if Robbie plays it on his show, everyone's going to want it. I mean, that's business sense, you know. And, I mean, actually delivered by a van parking outside your house with the hot inputs off the flight. I mean, that's incredible, isn't
that's
it?
Fantastic, yeah. Like you said, he'd done the jazz breaks, influenced a lot of people on that side of it. Now, that kind of started the threads for the so-called jazz people coming along, didn't they? The DJs that are coming along and just specialised in that side of it.
Mm.
Who was the first, more or less, that decided to go that way, a break away from the soul scene at the time? Sorry if I put you on the spot.
What, in the clubs?
Yeah, totally decided, right, I'm moving away, I'm going with this way, and breaking.
Well, it would be very easy for me to say Paul Murphy, of course.
Yeah.
My research shows that the first out-and-out jazz dance session was actually in Brighton at Paul Clark and Mick Clark.
Yeah.
It didn't last very long, and they only had about 30 or 40 people there, but Paul Mick, and then there was a session in Southend run by an import shop down our way called Record Man, Colin and Trisha's show, Snow, that they did sessions. Chris Brown, had his, session at Jackson's, on a Tuesday, which was just all fusion. Sean French was doing a jazz-only session by the mid-80s. But, of course, Paul Murphy came in. He's a Essex guy, really. I think he's from Ilford. Mm. But he grew up going to the clubs Goldmine and the Lacey Lady in Ilford, the Essex clubs. And he started a session in London called The Horseshoe, which was jazz, funk and jazz mixed together. Not exclusively, but almost... certainly 80% black crowd, was going there. It's quite edgy, much more dancer, much more of a dancer crowd.
And at that raw sound as well, was he one of the first to actually go back?
Jonesy was the first to start playing bebop on the dance floor.
Mm.
At K-Star in the jazz room there.
Yeah.
I mean, Mr. PC, John Coltrane. I remember hearing that he'd played that at K-Star, and I thought, there's no way anyone can dance to that kind of thing, you know. No, just couldn't. It's so weird, isn't it? I mean, it's so easy to dance to and all that stuff, but
yeah,
such an unusual, because we were all basically we were playing fusion, weren't we? That was the thing. I think one of the things that really changed the whole scene was two things really musically was deleted American imports that we got over here. What we call cutouts, weren't they?
Yeah.
I mean, you could buy them everywhere, but obviously there was specialty shops, certainly in London, Bluebird, obviously City Sounds, all the import shops were carrying them. You could even get cutouts in Our Price Records,
yeah,
which is where Paul Murphy used to work.
And we had Andy's Records.
Andy's Records, and forgotten the names of the great shops.
What was
in the north? A1 Records in Glasgow, which was the big one for Bob Jeffries.
What was the one you got lost in for days and days? Well, I used to anyway. Tottenham Court Road on the corner used to be there. I'd be there for just, they had so much stuff in there, jazz-wise and soul-wise.
What was that
Tower called? Or something it was called. Oh, I can't remember.
I can't remember. But it was just floods of it everywhere, wasn't there? But there was so many new, all of a sudden, and they were cheap, of course. They were like about a third of the price of an import album. Or a new release album, anyway, but so many new tracks got discovered there, didn't they?
Then
we had all the Japanese imports coming in, again, thanks to Tony Monson, bringing all the Japanese imports, Japanese fusion in. So you had all these cutouts and this Japanese fusion coming in, and then, of course, by about 81, I'm not sure if it was 81, 82, of course, then Paul Murphy started his own record shop called Fusions, and he was importing stuff in.
Was that his first record shop?
Before then he was the buyer, head buyer for Our Price Records.
Right, yeah.
So, and he had loads of contacts. He was just buying blind from, warehouses in America. You know, just thinking, oh, you know, I was a, he'd buy 100 Ingram albums, 50 Jack McDuff albums, and he was taking chances on stuff, and all of a sudden, within a year or two, there was, all of a sudden, we had just literally hundreds and hundreds of new tracks to discover, you know, to play on the dance floor. There was it was an explosion, wasn't it?
It was, because there was a three or four of us used to come up from Bedford on the train on a Friday afternoon to Paul's shop, because he used to get a load come in on a Friday afternoon.
Yeah.
And he introduced me to people like Richard Cole, Eddie Jefferson, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But they were £2.50 at the time. Yeah, and you used to think, wow, that's dear.
Yeah,
you know, at the time you did.
Yeah, yeah.
But today.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, and your deeper kind of fusion stuff as well, isn't it? Like Barry Miles and all these artists. I mean, I think it just sent everyone on a massive journey, didn't it, of discovery all of a sudden. There's just so much to buy and discover.
Yeah, and of course, going back to Robbie Vincent done that with Radio London. Then you got the pirate stations coming along in London, one of them, Invictus Radio.
Yeah.
People like Chris Hill at the time and other DJs on there. And that was actually doing quite well, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah, it was. I think that was owned by Tony Monson again, wasn't it, Invictus Radio?
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, that's right. I mean, obviously, pirate radio, although through that period, you know, was really fueled, they were tastemakers, weren't they? They were tastemakers.
Yeah. Should we hear another track? Let's have a coffee break. Radio 105 FM in the heart of Cambridge, www.209radio.co on the web. And if you want to email Snowboy with any questions about the book, which is called From Jazz Funk to Fusion to Acid Jazz, which has just been released, and Snowboy is my special guest in the studio. And a big shout out to Will. We're not sure if it says Will in Harlow or Will Harlow. So sorry about that. But, beautiful tune.
Yeah, it's great. It's, Yeah, Flora Purim, what game should we play today? It's actually, it was an unreleased version from a Chick Corea Return to Forever double CD from about 4 or 5 years ago. There's about 10 versions of it on there, so it was quite hard to pick the best one, but I just cut that onto a little 45 for me to play out.
Lovely.
It's amazing, isn't it? It's incredible. It's nothing like the original version. Nothing at all like the original version on the album, so I do suggest that people do go out and buy this Return to Forever double CD to just to get that alone.
Yeah, well, they're just special, them albums, aren't they?
Yeah.
If you're really going to go into it, you might as well start into the real good stuff.
That's right, exactly. Yeah.
And then spread out.
There you go.
That's the way to do it. But you do that with certain jazz albums. You think, so why did they recommend this? And years later, you put it on and you're thinking, why didn't I hear this in the first place?
You know, your tastes change, don't they?
Yeah.
This next track, actually it's Flora Purim singing on it again, as we're talking about all the Japanese jazz and jazz fusion coming through, weren't we, in the late 70s, early 80s, and to me, this is one of the greatest examples. It's half Japanese, half American musicians. It first, certainly from a southern perspective, it came in as a new release the day of an all-nighter at Flicks in Dartford. And it was a hot import that day, straight in from Japan. It's a project called Pacific Jam, and this is a track called Onsei de Manada.
to Don over there in Boston. Hiya, glad you're tuned in, sir. Enjoying the music. What do you mean the show can't get any better than today? that's an insult.
Yeah. You can stop listening after this week. Then.
Just in case you're tuning in, you're listening to Soul Discovery on the Jazz Tip with Snowboy as my special guest. Colin Curtis was due in today. Colin, our thoughts go with you at the present time. And Chris Hill, who couldn't be here either. But don't worry, we're regrouping, aren't we, in the future?
Wouldn't that be amazing to Colin Curtis and Chris Hill and hopefully Bob Jones all in the studio at the same time?
With no room for music then.
No. The most important British DJs ever.
Oh, that's all.
All in one room. Wow.
Oh, dear. Right, that tune.
Yeah, so Pacific Jam, Monte Di Minada, so many great tracks on that album anyway, but we were just saying really of the fusion that was being played in those days, really it was the Latin tinged or samba tinged stuff, really. It was so, when we say we were dancing to fusion, it was really samba fusion, and I think a good example is what's coming up, a track that you've just chosen by the Brazilian percussionist Paulinho da Costa. Perfect example. It's fusion, but it's samba at the same time.
The dancing, that started to take on new heights, didn't it, in the jazz clubs?
It did. I mean, it varied around the country. There was a style that suddenly started to appear in predominantly in London, you know, through Paul Murphy's clubs, the Horseshoe, and then Electric Ballroom, which people used to define just as, they used to call the style fusion. It didn't mean it was a fusion of styles. Mm. It differentiated between the styles around the rest of the country, where, well, I don't suppose it was around the rest of the country. I mean, the original style was, I suppose, everyone, the more freestyle kind of dancers around the country, you'd thrown a bit of contemporary, a bit of ballet almost, didn't you? Like, the best dancers in the clubs always like to look as professional as possible, but I think as the DJs were playing heavier and heavier, particularly Paul Murphy playing heavier and heavier and faster fusion, the people in the Horseshoe and then later the Electric Ballroom started to, a style started to be defined in order to be able to take out these really fast fusion tracks. You know, they started coming out with steps. They were quite funky, really. It was more like the old jazz funk dancing, but sped up, wasn't it? But it was more kind of minimal. It was more about footwork and
very much
and,
so.
And
yeah.
Less from the hips upwards, there wasn't really a great deal going on. It was all about the fast footwork, wasn't it? But yeah,
and the track itself, because there were certain tracks that you used to look at them and you used to think, how the hell can they dance that? Because I can't. It was just too fast for me at
yeah.
the time.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I remember some of the in the book, you know, interviewing some of the earlier dancers, they said that it used to be very frustrating for them when the fusion really started to come through, and all these new young dancers, well, black really, entirely black, 95%, all these new young black dancers coming through. All over the country, demanding to the DJs that it was hard and fast fusion. Mm. And of course the earlier, like the older jazz dancers, they couldn't do their kind of ballet contemporary to the really lightning speed fusion tracks. So like they were a bit alienated on the floor for all these youngsters coming through with all this fast footwork, you know, so yeah. The fusion styles.
So hence the two-step scene.
Yeah.
Slow it down. But, yeah, very interesting. But, yeah, we'll play another track. 209 Radio, 105 FM, my special guest today. Are you enjoying yourself?
No, I don't like it.
I know. Not many people do.
Fantastic. Great to be here, mate. Honestly, fantastic.
Yeah, it's fantastic to have you in. We love each other, eh? Lots of love.
No tea bags, though. Where's these tea bags?
We're banned.
I'm an Englishman. I want my cup of tea.
Earl Grey.
With milk.
Discovery, and we're getting a few people are emailing in about the title of the book. Do you want to give it out again, please?
Yeah, it's called From Jazz Funk and Fusion to Acid Jazz, and it's on Chaser, but it's also co-published by Author House. So if you go to authorhouse.co.uk or authorhouse.com in America, and you can buy it online there or Amazon. It's not available generally in the bookshops at the moment, but it's available everywhere online.
Fantastic book, actually. It really is. So much stuff in there that I didn't know about, and some of them saying, you know, how you do it, I was there.
Yes,
as you do. But it's fantastic that someone's actually documented all this together at last, because we would have lost it, wouldn't we?
Had to be done, yeah. Well, as someone pointed out, it's 25 years of it's British black music club culture that's never been documented, you know. So, and it's, I didn't really even think of it in those terms until people actually were saying that's what I've done, you know. It's true.
From music around the world, it's unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, Northern Soul's been documented over and over and over again, of course. Brilliantly. But,
has it?
Yeah. I didn't say well, but it's been documented.
now. Right. We're talking about the jazz dance side of things.
Mm.
That really took off in a big way, didn't it? We're moving on there. You're on about the Electric Ballroom, aren't you?
Yeah, the Electric Ballroom. And Paul Murphy's session there in Camden, Electric Ballroom. The thing is, the music became so kind of militant, and this very specific dance style there. There was a definite division, certainly from a southern perspective, between more of a home counties kind of jazz dance scene and what was being played in London. And also there was a dress style as well. I mean, you could always tell, like, say, going down the gold mine, you could always tell who used to go to the Electric Ballroom to Paul Murphy's sessions just because of the way they dressed. There was a very specific style.
Very sharp.
They used to wear those rolled up... kind of, what do you call those bobble hats kind of thing?
Yeah. I know what you mean.
Yeah, you know, stretch jeans.
And the shoes.
The shoes. Yeah. The spats or those patent slippers or whatever. Yeah, there was a definite look of a jazz man from the Electric Ballroom, wasn't there?
Yeah. And the DJs, who are we talking about at the time?
Well, Electric Ballroom, of course, was Paul Murphy.
Yeah.
A little bit later when he left, Giles Peterson, of course.
Yeah.
The other DJs active at the time, of course, Sylvester, Baz for Jazz, plus the aforementions, of course, Bob Jones, etc.
Yeah.
God, Kevin Beadle. Oh, this is endless. There was so many jazz DJs around at that time, wasn't there?
Yeah, and this became its own sort of market then. It had moved away from the complete soul scene, hadn't it?
Yes. There was a definite breakaway jazz dance scene. Loads of kind of residences, in back rooms of pubs, as wine bars, as we used to call them as well. Wasn't there, you know?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
It was almost like any kind of major high street in...
And that affected...
In any town, there was a residency going on.
And also that made the Weekenders, they became their own sort of, clientele, for the DJs that were specifically booked for that jazz room, weren't they?
That's right, yeah, when you think of those big Weekender, events, you know, you had your smaller room, didn't you?
Yeah.
There was the jazz room, and of course from the Midlands to the North, all the all days that were going on virtually every weekend, there was always a smaller jazz room there as well. You know, let's not forget, you know, that all these amazing DJs from the Midlands, you know, to the North, you know, also specialising in jazz. Most incredible guys, Chris Reid, Eric X, Baz lived in London, of course he was from Coventry in the Midlands, but he was just as famous in the North, and of course, Hugh and Clark, and of course Colin Curtis was massive in all scenes.
It was a new generation as well.
A new generation, yeah, a new generation that, for sure. Because the thing is, I mean, you and I are talking about these specialist rooms, like rooms within a room, if you like.
Yeah.
You know, you've got the main room for the more mainstream, you know, kind of funk and imports at the time. But these small rooms playing the jazz. It's like, to me, going to a Weekender at, a Caster or something, you know, you would get people that would just go to the small room and that's where they would stay all weekend. They wouldn't even dream of going into the main hall. I think it's worth pointing out to listeners as well that when we talk about weekenders, these are in holiday resorts that we used to call like holiday camps. They were just kind of self-contained holiday resorts. Well, they still exist here, don't they? But
yeah,
but they do have similar things around the world.
And it was more or less the first thing that, I think the first one ever was Caister, wasn't it? It was Robbie Vincent's idea at the time. I'm not sure on that one.
Yeah, well, it was in our scene.
Yeah.
I mean, Robbie actually claims that it was his idea, but it was his idea to do a soul one.
Right.
But because the people that put on Caister at the time was Showstoppers. The promoters, Showstoppers, and they were doing it at Vauxhall Park in Caister, mm-hmm. on the East Coast. But there was already weekenders going on at that venue. Showstoppers weren't black music promoters;
they were promoters.
No. Showstoppers were already doing rock and roll, rockabilly weekenders out there. And I think that Robbie probably had the idea. Well, if they can.
Yeah, why can't we?
Yeah, why can't we? Yeah, but
yeah,
it certainly wasn't Robbie's idea to do a weekender because Showstoppers were already doing them. But a soul one had never been done before. No,
and the thing about it as well, moving way forward, you're talking about Giles Peterson and that coming. But the American artists started to come over, didn't they? You got people that were being brought over just specifically for the jazz scene.
Yeah, outside of the legitimate jazz clubs, obviously like Ronnie Scott's, Paul Murphy would bring in Tanya Maria, Jay Hoggard, Heath Brothers, there was just so many, and they would just come in and just, he would grab them if they were on tour in Europe, and you'd find out about them, and just bring them in strictly just for one gig, and they'd be off again.
Yeah.
It must have been a real shock for all of those artists, just seeing all this dance style and hearing what the DJs were playing.
I've got a little story I'll tell later to the track, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
I think you're the guest, but I've got to tell it, because won't be told anywhere else.
Okay.
But, but your next tune.
This is just one that reminds me of, those tracks it's very typical of the fusion that was getting played in those days. This was by a band called Ariel. I think they're from Sweden. It's a track called The Girl With Three Faces. We'll be right back.
Oh yes, those that are just joining us, you've missed a fantastic show. Well, we've got just over an hour, under an hour left of Snowboy's my special guest, and we're talking about his new book, From Jazz, Funk and Fusion to Acid Jazz, and we'll give you the details later on in the show, but absolutely fantastic, looking at the UK scene through the course of jazz, funk, right up to jazz today, I suppose. Yeah.
Well, the book finishes probably in the mid-90s, really, when acid jazz kind of went worldwide and...
Right, we'll come across that one later.
And whatever.
No, we've got to talk about it. So.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
But that tune, oh, absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, yeah, brings back a lot of memories to me. And another good example of samba fusion, but not samba enough for Brazilian music lovers to perhaps enjoy. But it's, you know, because it was those... Because I think in those days, I think there's a lot of the fusion artists... You know, they would do, like, something more funky or something more rocky. They might do a ballad on the album. And if they wanted to do something with a bit of a Latin flavour, like the samba thing, you know, was the Latin rhythm of the time. Whereas now it's, you know, the kit drummers will tend to, if they're going to do a Latin thing, it might be something more Cuban, perhaps, you know. So it's, but the samba was, you could almost buy any fusion album and there was going to be, if there was going to be a Latin track on there, it was going to be kind of like samba fusion. You know, that was just the in sound, I guess. But virtually every fusion album you bought had one on it as well, as you well know.
Yeah.
I did want to say that it's such a shame, you know, because of personal circumstances that Colin Curtis can't be here today, and of course one of the world's great black music DJs, you know, one of the innovators in this country of so many different styles of black music on the dance floor. And because it is worth mentioning about the, obviously we're talking from a southern perspective, but of course things were moving slightly different in the Midlands and the north of England, you know, just because of course Colin's great club Berlin in Manchester, where that was like the, you know, whereas we had the Electric Ballroom, they had Berlin. And of course, whereas Berlin wasn't all jazz, Colin would play soul in there as well, but you know, like, it was, Colin would play jazz of all styles in there. He'd play really kind of hard fusion like you would just hear there, and he'd be playing some really good kind of floaty, you know, kind of, you know, mid-tempo jazz thing. So the more expressive, more balletic style jazz dancers could dance to that. And of course he would introduce the kind of Afro-Cuban stuff like mambo, a lot of mambo jazz, which is very popular there. And Colin, like so many of the great, DJs in the North, he discovered so many brilliant records that we just take for granted right now, you know, like Quartet Trebien, Boss Trebien, you know, one of the all-time,
fantastic.
Definitely a Colin Curtis track.
That was the only record he ever discovered then.
Who was it, Colin? yeah, that and a thousand others, yeah. But yeah, it was just such a different, obviously by then, obviously DJs were starting to travel around the country, but I think, you know, whereas we had tons of residencies down the south, you know, in back rooms of pubs and wine bars, as I say, but of course in the north there was less clubs playing it. It was all revolved around, there was as many people involved in it, but they obviously they had their all-dayers in different northern cities every weekend, didn't they? And you tend to get, you know, like the main room playing the imports and the soul. And I suppose later it'd be more electro-based kind of stuff, wouldn't it, in the main rooms, you know, and your D-Train, you know, and those kind of...
And of course the scene completely changed as well with, we're going back again, places like Hacienda and everything, totally different direction as well.
In the early days of the Hacienda, they did play jazz in there. I left my phone on, sorry. Sorry, listeners. Of course, in the early days of the Haciendas, the resident dancers there were the very famous jazz dance crew there called the Foot Patrol, you know, and they just used to let them in free and give them free drinks, and they'd always be keeping the floor going, and yet they were dancing in the London fusion style. That's what the Foot Patrol were really into. So of course, because I was told that house, even though people think of like house, you know, house music, like Hacienda's the home of house music or whatever, they did actually, I was told that they were struggling with house music at the Hacienda at the time as it was that they used to, the foot patrol were dancing to it on the dance floor, making it, you know, keeping the floor going with that stuff.
Yeah, accessible,
and that they really helped, you know, towards, you know, help establish that stuff in the club. It's only what I've been told in research. Obviously, I wasn't there.
Yeah.
And of course, the owner of Factory Records, was the owner of Hacienda, Tony Wilson, and he used to manage the Jazz Defectors, who were one of the original jazz dance crews in the north of England. So, who would have thought there was a jazz element to such a big independent kind of label that had New Order and, you know, Joy Division, etc.
Exactly,
know?
Yeah. Fantastic, eh?
Certain ratio, of course, yeah. Clear.
The branches get wider,
yes,
don't
I know.
But this tune you're going to play now.
Yeah, this is something that I brought back from Japan. I was there recently for 3 weeks doing a tour with my band and also to promote my book, which was available there in Japanese. And I noticed this record is actually from 1981. It would have been big here. I know as soon as you hear it, you'd think, you know, this sounds like a classic. We obviously didn't get it imported at the time because it would have been massive. So hopefully it's a bit of a snowboard discovery. It's by Enley. It's a version of Wave from 1981.
Thank you.
I like that.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing, isn't it? Amazing. Amazing.
And what year is that from?
1981.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah. It's that sort of sound, isn't it?
Yeah.
That period.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Yeah, it couldn't have come over because everyone would have been playing that, because that was, well, I mean, the next track that you've got lined up is a perfect example. It's so similar, you know, and this was a bona fide stone classic in our scene, isn't it? See You Later by Joanne Grauer.
Yeah, much so.
Picture this, my dear. For the end is almost here. But I'll see you later. How could I know? What was in my mind when all I'd show was what was in my heart? Things that hung me up, it'd drive me crazy. Isn't it enough that for us the time ran out? Is it really that our love is really blind? Keep this thought in mind, that I'll see you later on should find
There you go, every note.
Good, good, good.
You were concerned.
I know, we've got to get that break in. We've got to get that Batucada in there. Oh, yeah.
Right.
Best bit of the song.
Yeah. Ooh.
Which we're talking about the electric ballroom, and I mean, Paul Murphy felt very kind of hemmed in there because it got to the point where it was just the tempo was being dictated to, but it was being dictated by the dancers really, and there's other kind of jazz that Paul wanted to play. So Paul left, you know, obviously when he started the Wag and started playing mid tempo bop and salsa and all kinds of other kind of jazzy stuff, and of course Giles Peterson took over from Paul Murphy. That was really Giles's first big break. Mm. And Giles felt the same. He felt it was very restricted at the Electric Ballroom for exactly the same reasons as Paul Murphy, that it was fast or nothing, you know, with that crowd, or heavy or nothing. And at that point, Giles started to play at a place called the Royal Oak, these events called, these nights called the Special Branch. And of course you had your home counties DJs, didn't you? Like, Sean French and Pete Tong, Bob Jones, but of course you had your Paul Oakenfolds and people like that, didn't you? It was run by Nicky Holloway as well.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
yeah, and
that's a name out of the past.
Yeah, that's right. So so you know, you were getting the best of the kind of the new breed of kind of the cutting edge DJs from London mixed with the home counties kind of old guard, you know, the jazz funk DJs, and a fantastic mix. Of course, Giles was. And Chris Bangs, of course, all part of that, and it meant that Giles could play his jazzy flavours of all different tempos, you know, to that kind of crowd, and you couldn't get away with that at the ballroom. So bit by bit, he kind of
yeah
faced himself out of the ballroom.
He kind of influenced his own sound as well, didn't he?
Yeah, that's right. And of course, these were the days of Rare Groove as well. So, so you know, and that was what was so great about the Royal Oak is that, you know, you can hear a breakneck speed fusion track, you know, next to some kind of mid tempo bossa, and then you'd hear some kind of rare funk 45 next to it, you know, influenced by the Rare Groove scene that was happening at the time. Is it was getting back to the idea of quality freestyle sessions, yeah, really, exactly, weren't they?
Yeah.
Or if you like jazz-based kind of freestyle sessions.
Back around the base of the DJ.
Yeah.
The DJ was in control again.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's right. And of course this was really, really the basis of what the acid, you know, how the acid jazz thing started really was, you know, was that mixture of all these different styles of music.
What that terminology, where did that come from?
It started at a Special Branch event at the Waterman's Arms in what part of London are we? Southwest, I guess. It was a night. By then, Acid House had just come out. Nicky Holloway was playing stuff on, you know, the Chicago Tracks label and stuff like that. But of course, the Special Branch, because it was a mixture of all different styles of DJs, you know, you were having nights where you were getting Acid House and you were getting Giles Peterson and Chris Bangs playing their selection of kind of funky Rare Grooves and jazz of all tempos all in one night, you know, which is, you know, very adventurous.
Was Bangsy put into that bracket though of the acid jazz at the time, or
really Chris Bangs and Giles were DJing together all the time.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Because, I mean, Giles' first break really was as a backup DJ to Chris Bangs in the first place, you know, going back much earlier. So, but they were doing this night at the Waterman's Arms, this Special Branch night, and Giles was DJing, but like, by then, say, the Acid House thing was in, and there was all this kind of strobe lighting and the kind of all these, you know, the kind of acid slogan earrings, and this word acid kept on getting flashed behind Giles while he was DJing, and he was playing this really fast Art Blakey and Sabu track, flashing away there, and Giles turned around to Chris Bangs and said, he's going, what's this all about, you know, because there was playing fast Afro-Cuban with acid, and then Chris Bangs went, well, it's acid jazz, isn't it, you know, like that.
Right.
And then Giles got on the mic and went, yeah, acid jazz, like that, over the mic, you know. And
that simple.
There's other stories, but that's the first time
certain tracks though, wasn't there?
Around that time, you know, as the acid jazz thing, they started talking about sloganeering, calling it the Freedom Principle, because you get, you know, these are jazz-based freestyle nights, and you're hearing all kinds of music being played in there, even kind of jazzy, new kind of jazzy house kind of things being played in there, some jazzy hip-hop, all kind of getting mixed in, and they talk about the Freedom Principle. There's a track that had been around for quite a few years. I think it actually was discovered by a record dealer local to here from Clacton called Tony's Imports, who used to do record stalls at the Boy in Royston near here.
That's right, yeah. On Thursday night as well.
Yeah. And Bob Jones's jazz sessions in Chelmsford. Tony.
But Bob done the Bull in Royston.
That's
as well.
Right. Yeah. That's right. I know he did. Yeah. And but Tony's Imports was a very, very important record dealer. I mean, I interviewed him for the book because I thought he was equally as important as Paul Murphy in some ways, because he discovered a lot of stuff as well that people don't realise. And this track that he discovered later became much, much, you know, brought to, its full importance came through once the acid jazz scene was established because of the Freedom Principle, as I talk about. And it's Ferro Sanders, You Gotta Have Freedom.
will play this for someone. You were talking about the tribes earlier.
Yeah.
The Bedford Squires over in Bedford.
Okay.
We were part of them.
You were? Okay.
Oh, yeah. But that was one of their anthems, and they absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
And, so that's Morris Moroney, McAvoy, you're on about Eddie, Trevor. There were so many of them, and the girls as well, the Bedfordshire girls, who were gorgeous. They're all married now. Forgot about it all.
Yes, of course, yeah.
They moved on. But some of us are still involved.
Yeah,
so,
that's
but,
right.
Fantastic tune. Absolutely, blinding.
Yeah, amazing, amazing. I mean, and also, because let's not forget, I mean, most of the stuff we've been playing today is kind of almost breakneck speed. I mean, it was jazz of all, you know, for any listeners outside of the UK, I mean, it was jazz of all tempos that was played and all styles. I think that, you know, because, you know, obviously we've been talking about these special brunch things and then, you know, how the term acid jazz came about. Well, of course, then Giles had his most famous residency, of course, at Dingwalls in Camden on a Sunday lunchtime, which was very, very special. There was always a live act every week, and early doors it was Patrick Forge playing 2 hours of the hardest jazz known to man. Not necessarily fast, but some of it certainly was, but esoteric, as you like. And then after the band, then Giles would do his thing. And of course, you would hear anything from the kind of jazzy, rare, groovy stuff to it's a samba, batucada, carnival rhythms to say it's jazzy house in the end. Although I remember him nearly getting lynched for playing the Fight the Power, Public Enemy in there, the instrumental with
that was the experiment period, wasn't it?
Yeah, Masalis playing on it. And
was Giles on? He was on Jazz FM at the time, wasn't he?
He was on Jazz. He was on Radio London with Mad on Jazz. And then
what was the show? I used to love the what was it called? The Vibra Zone, was it? Was that the
Vibra Zone? Yeah,
absolutely unique. That was special.
Yeah. No, I mean, Giles had a massive following, and so, I mean, obviously, still does. I mean, he's a worldwide star now. But yeah, he's such a
He brought a new direction.
He was a real Pied Piper, wasn't he? And people were really, he could single-handedly, change the direction. And of course, Jonathan Rudnick saw the way Dingwalls was working, all these different styles, and then he wanted to do a session in New York like that, based on Dingwalls, and he did, called Giant Steps. And Jonathan told me, as he says in the book, he said, the trouble is because it's not trouble, but the thing is, New York is so immersed in the hip hop culture, the jazz dance thing was never going to work in the same way that it did in London. It was always going to be different, and rightly so, vive la difference, etc. I think that the problem is that, when the acid jazz thing really took hold, with the Talking Loud label, obviously Acid Jazz Records, of course, and there were so many different styles of music coming through, and of course it was becoming a bit of a worldwide, spreading worldwide, a whole new crowd coming in, all the students, certainly in the UK, it must have been the same worldwide, but of course they've not come from the jazz dance background, and there was a lot of people who couldn't really understand the jazz element in it all, they didn't necessarily, they couldn't necessarily take the jazz side of it. People, I think, were concentrating more on the funkier side of what was acid jazz, because it was confusing people. I mean, you'd hear Ferris Sanders, and then you'd hear Gangstar, and then you'd hear Tito Puente, or myself even, obviously I was recording since the late 80s myself, and you'd hear house, and then you'd hear soul, and people were going, well, what is acid jazz? Well, exactly, it was a scene that, it was more a movement rather than a style of music, and in actual fact, there is not a style of music called acid jazz. There's no such thing as acid jazz music. It was a scene. And and this is the problem, when it's spread outside of that community, like I said, the London the kind of community, if you like, people liked it, they liked the what was going on around it, but people couldn't actually define what was acid jazz, and of course they can't define what acid jazz was, because there wasn't one type of music that was acid jazz, it was a scene, and really this is where my book finishes, was actually the worldwide explosion. In the end, that's it. That's what people were saying. What is acid jazz? It was something that had gone way past people got attracted to, the look of it, the obviously you got your bands like Jamiroquai, James Taylor Quartet, Brand New Heavies, Galliano, all these kind of thing. But then you've got Guru's Jazzmatazz, right? So now you're starting to go into the, you're going into the hip hop world. You've got Mother Earth, which is rock, like 70s rock. Corduroy, which is more kind of library music, kind of kitschy stuff. But these are, but most of the stuff's all got, is the more funkier bass stuff, you know, the,
Did it confuse the American side?
Not just America, everywhere. I mean, it certainly confused the new generation worldwide, right. I think. You know, this is the problem. I mean, I think, but tons of amazing music got made under the banner of acid jazz. So I think whatever you call it, you know, like Mondo Grosso in Japan, for instance, amazing stuff, you know, or, you know, all this superb stuff that, you know, that's come out in America. So many other labels, you know, Germany, Sweden, of course, you know, Wizards of Ooze from Belgium, loads of stuff that came out at that time. No matter what you want to call it, it was great music, but it was all very misunderstood. I remember one student coming up to me one day and saying, and I put this in the book, someone said to me, you don't look acid jazz, you know, you know, what are you, you know, what are you to, you know, what are you to do with acid jazz? And yet I'm making Afro-Cuban jazz music. Mm. I was one of the first, my album, my debut album, I've made 15 albums now, my debut album was on acid jazz. It was one of the first albums on acid jazz.
Yeah.
And Giles wanted it on there to show the diversity of the scene, the freedom principle. People just couldn't understand, you know, people were trying to...
It had always been there, but it had been tagged with this name. It had always been there.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. You know, these just ended up, they were just kind of jazzy freestyle nights, yeah. Really, but of all styles of music, but people just tended to concentrate. It all ended up getting so conservative in the end, you know, it had to be funky, and you know, and it was probably had to have the obligatory rap in the middle of it somewhere or other.
Yeah, the term... acid jazz, as people turn away from that now, or...
Yeah, I mean, you know, as Eddie Piller will tell you, the owner of Acid Jazz Records, you know, I mean, you know, acid jazz, you know, in the mid-90s, the late-90s, you know, it became a dirty word, you know, like the acid jazz.
From my side of things, the same thing happened with jazz funk. It became a dirty word.
Oh, didn't it? Yeah, well, that's a good example. I mean, that was 15 years earlier.
Yeah.
Exactly, because, well, there you go. You've hit the nail right on the head.
Yeah, till today, and then people are starting to realise that there was so much good music.
Mm.
Why turn against it? It's only a name, after all.
But that's right, because people called that, like, in the, about 80, 81, didn't they? They called our scene the jazz funk scene, didn't they? And yet you would hear the latest imports, black music imports, Philly soul, jazz fusion,
even some disco records.
There's so many amazing disco records. But people just called it the jazz funk scene in the end, didn't they? And of course, you could actually, as I said in the book, you could actually go to a jazz funk night, technically, called a jazz funk line. Yes, you wouldn't hear any actual jazz funk in it, you know.
No, you're right. That's totally right.
And it's the same with acid jazz. So for any listeners out there of a certain age that are confused about acid jazz, you know, I can tell you right now, as someone that was on Acid Jazz Records and was there from the beginning, there is no such music as acid jazz.
Samba guitar. Harmony's down, day into day just hanging around. I got no need be, and no love ties. Well now freedom turns to cast dies. Gotta move things, break the blue strings. Man arise, villainy's in, honor is down. Devil them all, there's ages around. Gotta search out, be who I'll be. Gotta find love, it's gotta find me. Gotta move things, break the blue string, breathing free. Hey! Hands to do, gotta try, mind to see. Try the sky, hands to do, gotta try, mind to see. Try the sky. Hey! working today, just hanging around. I got no DB and no love ties. Well, now freedom turns to cast eyes. Gotta move things, break the blue strings. Man, I rise. The villain is in. Honor is down. Dabble them all. Ages around. Time to search out. Be who I'll be. Time to find love. It's gonna find me. Gotta move things, break the blue strings. Breathe and free.
Oh, well, there you go.
Great, yeah. Big old Dingwalls. Another one that will always remind me of is a Dingwalls classic. That's acid jazz, if you like. Dancer's Inferno, samba guitar.
Right. Now, the listeners that are just tuning in, where have you been? You've missed a great show. Absolutely fantastic. And we're definitely going to come back in again, aren't you?
Yeah, well, definitely, without a doubt. Thank
you. Even if we don't get Chris Hill and Bob Jones and Colin Curtis, who needs them?
I know. We'll do a soul selection next time.
Yeah. Now, the book. Let's go back and refer to the book, because it's a great read. It's absolutely fantastic. I've enjoyed every minute of it. I only received it yesterday, haven't put it down since.
Good, good.
So, the name of the book is From Jazz, Funk and Fusion to Acid Jazz.
Yes.
For our listeners that have just tuned in, give us a quick...
It covers 25 years of, undocumented, information on the British black music club culture from 1970 to 1995, from our jazz funk scene through to acid jazz. And I've done over 200 interviews. It took over a 12-year period to do. It's available on Amazon, but we'd rather you bought it from authorhouse.co.uk or authorhouse.com, just because we earn more royalties, to be frank, because these massive companies do take a massive amount of money from us. Available everywhere. It's not in the bookshops yet, apart from in specialist black music shops. We'll be doing an event near you soon.
But the reaction you've got from people that have been involved with the book, is it been great?
The reaction's been incredible, and also the reaction from outside of the scene, because I think 10% of the people that buy the book will be from the scene, but because it's a cultural thing as well, you know, it goes into so many other areas. I mean, it's part of a course at Yale University in America. I just got an email the other day from a chap, Maurice Bottomley, who's a lecturer in Manchester University. It's part of the required reading there, you know, so it's...
Wow.
Yeah, so, because we're talking about, it's British black history, you know, club culture. Yeah. I mean, obviously, black music.
Yes.
We were talking about, obviously, so many, obviously, just so many white people involved as black, but what Chris Hill said, you know, we our scene did far more for racial harmony than any politician could ever contrive, just because everyone we're all there for the scene, for the music, you know, so,
totally agree.
That's right. So, yeah, I'm absolutely shocked and proud at the reaction the book's been getting worldwide, you know. I just can't get over it.
It's fantastic. Yeah. Now, part two.
No part two. I'm never going to write another book. And give it 6 months, and I never want to talk about this subject ever again either.
I'll have a little bet with you do.
Oh,
later on when you're retired.
Yeah.
In about 50 years' time.
Yeah, yeah.
You can look back and say, well, I need to do this.
Yeah.
So today, let's talk about today, if we can quickly.
Yeah.
The scene.
Mm.
How healthy is it?
Well, the scene has been really up until about, you know, after kind of Dingwalls closed and then the downturn with the acid jazz thing, and there wasn't really many heavy sessions happening. There's only really a few clubs left playing the more heavier end of the jazz dance scene, although
we
jazz is incorporated into a lot of other nights as well, which is great. interestingly enough, because of the interest in the book, all the media interest in the book, there's a lot of interest happening again, a lot of people talking about doing new nights, and I never expected this, but it seems like that this book is sparking off renewed interest in our scene.
Well, think of the generations that are just going to get into this stuff now. That have, all this music that's been sampled, and they're finding all the new stuff. I'm going to put you on the spot here. Who we got to look out for, artist-wise?
New artists?
Yeah, new artists.
Well, I suppose recently...
Yourself.
Myself. Well, yeah, of course. My CDs are required purchases, of course, you know, naturally. And, well, of course, we've had all this great Italian and Swedish jazz and Danish jazz, and, of course, all this great Japanese stuff coming through over the last few years, haven't we?
There's a thing...
Sleepwalker, Quasimodo...
Well, there's stuff coming out of Poland and the Baltic countries now, which is gaining momentum as well.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, that's right. So... Yeah, there's loads of acts around at the moment playing music specifically for the jazz dance crowd. I mean, I just got back from Japan, as I said. I was there for 3 weeks, and the scene is massive over there. So many jazz dancers. It's not funny. If you go onto YouTube, in fact, any listeners out there, if you go to YouTube and look up Stax Groove, STAX Groove, and check those dancers out, then there's hundreds like that in Japan at the moment. So fresh.
Another question out of the blue.
Yeah.
DJs that are coming up that we could look out for, apart from yourself.
And there's the problem. There's
because Giles is retiring, I believe. Is he?
Is he? Oh, it's not. No, it's not why.
Some people could take over. Then.
Yeah, no. I don't know really of any young DJs coming through. Okay. I think unfortunately, it's a bit like the Northern Soul scene. It's quite hard for new young DJs to come through because the DJs that have been around for years have got these immense collections. Youngsters really not going to be able to compete with. There's the problem. So the best thing to do for any new young DJ coming through playing this stuff is just concentrate on all the new release stuff, because there's so much of it out there at the moment that needs to be broken. We don't need to keep going back.
Yeah.
And that's the principle of your show here, your soul show, isn't it? You like to play, you know, a lot, break the new stuff, you know.
We try.
Yeah.
And talking of new stuff.
New stuff, yeah. This is a track from my latest album.
A good link.
Yeah, good one. Well done. An experienced presenter there. Yeah, this is the track from my latest CD, my 15th album, called Communication. The music I play is Afro-Cuban jazz, and obviously I specialise in, I'm a percussionist. And this track was written for me by the king of Latin music, Mr. Eddie Palmieri. It's a track called Snowboy Special.
That's not bad.
Oh, yeah, it's all right. It's okay. It's okay.
Who's it by again?
Yeah. Snowboy in the Latin Section, Freestyle Records.
And what's the name of the album?
The album's called Communication.
And that's available at all retail shops.
Yeah, anywhere in the world, yeah.
Right, okay, fantastic.
It better be, anyway. I shall be talking to the label.
Along with the book.
Yes.
The book. And the show will be up for iPod later, from 12 o'clock, and the track listing will be going out on the various forums later as well. And, well, your last tune, I'm afraid, coming up.
Right, okay, yeah, this...
Don't cry.
This guy is just so incredible. I got him as a guest on my last album, New Beginnings, on a cover of an old Ivory Joe Hunter track called Gotta Learn to Mambo. And he's a British rhythm and blues singer in that kind of Bobby Bland, Ray Charles kind of style. I'm sure a lot of your listeners from America are going to already know this guy. His name's James Hunter, and this is a track from his latest CD called She's Got Away.
Cured my mess with a one caress and didn't even have to raise a hand. And I don't know just what you do, but I know you got away with the you. Yeah. She got a way to send me and a way to bring me back. A one letter shake now is all it takes to stop me in my tracks. And I don't know what you do, but I know you got away with the yeah, what you do, but I know you got away with you.
I like that.
You do like that? Good.
Yeah.
Good, yeah.
Definitely.
The guy's amazing. He's just absolutely amazing. From Colchester, quite near here.
Right, just down the road.
Yeah, just down the road.
Oh, guy. And we're going to play another tune.
Another James Hunter track.
Yeah. Anyway, you're going to say goodbye because we're really running out of time really fast.
Sorry, it's only a short tune. Yeah, thanks very much. It's been great to be on here and to plug the book. You know, it's such a shame Colin Curtis couldn't have been here, but, yeah, thanks very much. Brilliant show, mate. Thank you.
No, you're the man. So, thank you very much for coming in and all its success with the book and the new album.
Thank you.
Well done.
Cheers.